Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? Welcome to another week of the Fundamental Health Podcast. Happy holidays to all. Thank you for joining me for another amazing wild ride. We're trying something different this week. I'm splitting up a technical episode into two parts. I got some feedback that some of you thought these long-form technical episodes were too much in one part, so we're going to split them up into bite-sized chunks. Let me know what you think. All right, you guys, I got to spend last weekend at Rome Ranch. I got to see how regenerative agriculture works. I got to harvest a deer, and I was reminded of the beauty of this, and again, of the importance of nose-to-tail nutrition. I hope that you are all eating well in this holiday season. Look for a controversial thoughts video on how to avoid gaining weight in this holiday season tomorrow. But in the short term, if you need more nose-to-tail nutrition in your life, check us out at Heart and Soil. Heartandsoil.co is the website. We are helping you all reclaim your ancestral birthright to radical health. Now, we've got Heart of the Warrior in stock. This is my favorite supplement, you guys, and we are seeing amazing reviews. It is heart and liver. These are my two favorite organs. You will feel this. This will be a kick in the pants in a good way. These nutrients will get into your body and really level up your game. We've got ImmuniMilk, which is just about the best immune support you could get. Proline-rich peptides, hepatocyte growth factor, which regenerates the gut. It's amazing stuff. Check us out at heartandsoil.co. And of course, Firestarter, as always, will help with your satiety and prevent those holiday pounds. Think about how to make good choices. Listen to the video tomorrow. Reclaim your ancestral birthright to radical health. I love you all. Heartandsoil.co. Thanks to James DeNicolantonio for coming on the podcast this week. We had an awesome discussion. He is a pharmacist, a PharmD, who has done a large amount of cardiovascular research and written many books, most recently, The Immunity Fix. We had an awesome conversation about immunity, how to enhance it. Guess what? Nose-to-tail nutrition is a big part of that. We talk about colostrum, unique nutrients, vitamin D, ultraviolet light, all those things. You will really love this podcast. Like I said, we split it up into two parts to make it more bite-sized. You'll get one part this week and one part next week, but they are both amazing. Let us know what you think of that. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review. Please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps me reach more people. It helps us do good work, and it is how we move this message forward. My goal is really, literally, to change the lives of hundreds of millions of people, to change the mainstream medical system, to help all of the medical doctors, providers, to change, to help them all wake up to the fact that food is so powerful and the medical paradigm that we are using is wrong in many cases. So help me on that goal. You guys are all a part of this. You've seen it firsthand. We are part of a huge wave that is breaking, and I believe in our lifetimes things will be very different. And James is a part of this too, and this conversation is a part of it. So as a thank you to all who leave reviews for my podcast, I am giving away a signed copy of my book every month. Listen to the podcast on the first week of every month to hear the winner, and then email me at drpaul@heartandsoil.co for your signed copy of the book. All right. Thank you also to my sponsors. Let's Get Checked. You guys have heard about them before. They are an awesome company helping you get blood work from home. Yes, from home. Did you know that across the globe, in terms of men's health, sperm counts are dropping precipitously 50% in the last 40 years? Hormonal imbalances are crazy. Reduced testosterone levels are commonplace. Is this you? Even if you're a woman, testosterone levels are important for your sex drive. Overall hormones are completely out of whack. One in four men over 30 have low testosterone and hormonal imbalance. It manifests as low energy or fatigue, erectile dysfunction, low sex drive, anxiety, brain fog. It's horrible, and you won't know about it unless you get tested. Often the answer is nose-to-tail nutrition. Let us help you out at Heart and Soil, or removing offending plants, getting more sleep, getting more vitamin D. But Let's Get Checked is helping you with this. They are making it easier. It's a fast, affordable, confidential way to get hormone testing at home, as well as many other things. You can get 20% off by going to the website. You ready for the website? You want to write this down. Try lgc.com/carnivoremd. That's the one that'll get you 20% off. You get choose your test online. It comes fast. You collect your sample, send it back. You can review it with a nurse. A doctor reviews it as well. You'll get testosterone, SHBG, prolactin, estrogen, free androgen index. It'll be helpful for men and women. And it is confidential. They are CLIA approved. All data is anonymized. It's not just for men who are in a funk. It's for everyone, men and women. You can also get a CRP. You can get omega fatty acids. Try lgc.com/carnivoremd. CARNIVOREMD. It's definitely the way to do it. I thought it was fantastically easy. I did it for myself. I got CRP and many other tests myself. This podcast has been sponsored by Let's Get Checked. Appreciate them greatly. I also super appreciate the folks at White Oak Pastures, whiteoakpastures.com, doing the good work, fighting the good fight in the regenerative agriculture space. They have so much good stuff, you guys. They have really what I think is some of the best meat I've ever had. They have organs. They have suet. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD for 10% off your first order. This will change your life because they have really some of the best meat I've ever had in my life. And they are doing, like I said, amazing work. Regenerative agriculture, the kind we support at Heart and Soil, puts carbon back into the soil. This is how we persist as Homo sapiens, as a species. If you want to have your children's children's children on this earth, we should be supporting farms like White Oak Pastures and Belcampo, belcampo.com, another regenerative farm in Northern California, making organic, regeneratively raised meat and organs. They have a carnivore bundle. They have suet. They have liver. They have heart. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD for 20% off your order there. Or if they are already running a promotion, you will get 10% off on top of that. For 30% off at belcampo.com, supporting regenerative agriculture is, I believe, our pledge to future generations. This is how we do it. All right, guys, onto the podcast with James. Like I said, please check us out at heartandsoil.co and leave me a review for this podcast at Apple Podcasts. Listen after the podcast for what is going on with me. James, thanks for coming on the podcast, my friend.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
So I'm super excited to talk to you today because immunity is a word that maybe has been mentioned like once or twice in the last few months. People are thinking there about their immune system a little bit. You recently wrote this book, The Immunity Fix. It's pretty in-depth. It's got over 2,000 references. I don't know how you guys did that. But we're going to dig into all sorts of topics about immunity, the immune system, maybe a little bit about the history of pandemics, and kind of just paint this picture for people that I've really been painting over the last few months on my podcast. But we'll try and paint it in broad strokes today and drill down where we can and give people maybe something that ties things together. But the overarching idea is, you have an immune system. We all have an immune system. The strength of your immune system is based on your overall health. And you and I have both been saying this, the overall metabolic health. And that's influenced by your diet and other exposures in your life. And it's really as simple as that. So, you know, it's funny. I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago with a gentleman named Frank von Hippel that I really would recommend people listen to if they haven't. He wrote a book called The Chemical Age. And what I took out of that conversation was that when humans shifted to farming 15,000 years ago, everything went off the rails in a lot of different ways. Our diet went down the tubes in terms of nutrient quality. We've both talked about that. I've talked about that in my book. And then people started living closer and closer together and doing things to the earth that caused standing water that led to malaria and all these other infections. And I just thought, man, if we don't appreciate ecosystems, you know, when we stopped hunting and gathering, which is this romanticized notion, but when we started farming and tilling the land, we both decreased the nutrients in the soil, and we created environments for many parasites and protozoa and things that are bad for humans to breed. And then we had to develop chemicals, which are inevitably bad for us and bad for the environment, to fight that. So in the beginning of your book, I appreciated the fact that there's some discussion of the history of pandemics. You want to walk us through that a little bit as we get started? And maybe talk a little bit about the Spanish flu. And I thought it was particularly interesting the way that they treated that. But you highlighted this in your book, that a lot of the pandemics have happened in the past because there's just too many people in one place. And that's another thing that's the direct result of farming.
So when I was doing research for the immunity fix, what was really interesting is that actually a lot of this factory farming, these housing all these animals together, is actually driving a lot of these pandemics. And so essentially, this is what's really interesting, okay? Because you know, you start wondering, like, you know, where are these like, you know, pandemics coming from, essentially? Well, there's actually certain like groups of monkeys deep in rainforests that if another tribe, like another different group of monkey comes in contact with them, they actually have, and let's say they fight and they get blood contamination from each other. Certain groups, they have essentially this defense mechanism that will wipe out the other tribe. Okay. So like when you start essentially going in deep into the rainforest, like we used to do, and we started eating like bushmeat from chimpanzees, that's what led to HIV. Okay. And so when you start like deforesting and start like actually exposing these you know, animals that humans have never been introduced to, and then you start integrating those animals with like a ton of factory farming animals, it can jump to humans then. And so essentially a lot of these pandemics are coming from, let's say, bats infecting factory farm pigs, which takes about a year to go through them. Then they learn how to jump to humans. And this is where a lot of these pandemics are coming from. So regenerative farming is like a solution to get out of these crazy pandemics that are, a lot of them are being driven through factory farming.
It's so interesting to think about that. And that's the same, that's really the same paradigm that's got us started with all of this, right? It was the move from hunting and gathering to living in an environment, to living in an ecosystem, to tilling the land, to, and then we went the next step. So not only did we start farming 10,000 years ago, now we started factory farming, clustering animals, cloistering animals. And yeah, that the same kind of thing came up when I was discussing this with Frank. Then there's the question of, we're way too close to animals that we never would have been around like this. You know, you hunt an animal, it's very far away. You butcher it, you eat it. You're not around it when it's living. And there's not thousands of animals clustered in one spot in really poor conditions. It's just, I start to see the theme over and over that our system of animal husbandry, and in connection, our system of raising plants with monocrop agriculture, has really led to so many of these problems. And is it any wonder, you know? And people have shared these notions of coronavirus as a signal from the earth that humans have gone off track. And I, in some ways, I think you could make that argument. I do believe that it's a viral particle that is infecting us, but these viral particles, the fact that they are infecting us. And then if you look back at the previous pandemics, like the Spanish flu fought in World War I, when, you know, we were, many men were fighting, you know, in trenches and poor conditions of hygienic status, and then really bad nutrition, and then traveling to really crowded places. It was the same kind of thing. And then if you look back to other plagues, whether it was the bubonic plague, in the first bubonic plague, or the recurrences of Yersinia pestis, they were in places with horrible living conditions for people, like a bunch of people all living in a city and pooping and peeing in the streets. And then these rats moving this Yersinia pestis around. It's the type of conditions that our ancestors would never have tolerated, you know, living in a village. It's like, we're not going to shit in the middle of the village, right? Like, we're going to go in the woods. And it's the type of stuff that inevitably happens when thousands or hundreds of thousands of humans live together in a city without any sewage systems. And so it really is just this idea that keeps coming back to me that, goodness gracious, we've gone so far off track. I don't know how we get back. We can talk about that at the end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what's more scary than coronavirus is there have been other viruses that have come up over several decades, primarily being, and then the most lethal being driven by pigs and being driven by birds in Hong Kong. To give you an example, there's been certain spikes over the past several decades in Hong Kong where the bird flu was so close to jumping to humans that the director of the World Health Organization had to order the killing of millions of birds. Because most experts said we were within weeks of this really becoming a potential person-to-person pandemic. And to give you an example of how virulent H5N1 is, it has a case fatality rate of 60%. So can you imagine if that actually got out? If the World Health Organization did not order the killing of millions of birds, and we don't even realize this, we go by our day and we think like, you know, coronavirus only comes along like once every, you know, these pandemics once every 100 years. But if you actually look at the data, we have been very close to having explosions of much more virulent viruses than coronavirus. So that brings us to the point of, yes, how do we fix this? Which would be stop factory farming, number one, and switch over to regenerative farming, right?
Yeah,
that's not only going to produce healthier food, but that's going to dramatically reduce the risk of these, you know, very virulent pandemics from exploding. But then it's also going to fix our nutrition, because regenerative farms produce much more nutrient dense animal foods and plant foods. And it's obviously carbon net negative. So a lot of people don't understand there's differences between just, let's say, grass-fed meat and something called adaptive multi-paddock grazing, which can be -6 pounds net carbon negative for every pound of carcass on an adaptive multi-paddock grazing pattern, which essentially means instead of just letting the cows decimate one field of grass, you move them around different paddocks so they don't destroy the vegetation and the soil is still intact. And when you have farms like that, it's amazing how good it is for the environment.
And that right there is such a controversial notion that doesn't need to be controversial, but that's an explosive notion that animals can be good for the environment, that they have been good for the environment for millions of years. There were 150 million elk, pronghorn, antelope, deer, buffalo living in North America. They created some of the most fertile soil in the world. And then we monocropped the crap out of it for the last few hundred years. And thus we're left with really infertile, fallow soil, or, you know, really bad soil. I was just at Rome Ranch over the weekend, which is a regenerative farm here in Texas with the folks from Force of Nature Meats, another company doing amazing work in the regenerative space by aggregating a lot of these regenerative farms together. But it's so cool seeing what they're doing at Rome. And you can see over I think they've had the farm 4 years now. And there you can see paddocks or, you know, pastures of land that originally were completely barren. They showed us pictures, completely decimated, full of chemicals. And now they're starting to grow things again as they've put, and the way they do that is by putting animals on the land in an adaptive multi-paddock rotational grazing system. And so we got to go out and see the buffalo, and the buffalo are their machine. They put the buffalo on the land, and the buffalo pooping and peeing is what regenerates the land. And that's so cool that these ruminants that are in, that really are native to North America, the buffalo are, this is our heritage large mammal since we killed all the woolly mammoth. These are the animals that created healthy soil. So I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that these pandemics give us a clarion call that we need to really promote and support this type of agriculture more than ever, because otherwise we're just going further and further into this horrible dark night of pandemics and really bad infections. It's just going to get worse, I think. I mean, like you said, H5N1 jumps to humans. That's a nightmare.
Yeah, that's going to be, we're, you know, we can, and certainly, you know, metabolic health is going to play a role in that too. But even still, if something like that ever happened, most people are going to need some type of exogenous substance to reduce that type of lung damage that occurred. I mean, you can die within days. So most people with coronavirus, they'll die within 2 to 3 weeks. If you get like a bird flu, you can die within days, like 2-3 days, and that's it. But what's interesting, and we, you know, no one really talks about this aspect of animal foods, is that when you buy a factory farmed, let's say, piece of meat, typically that animal only lives for 14 to 16 months. So whereas if you buy meat from a regenerative farm, you know, bison and elk, they can live anywhere from 24 to 40 months before they're slaughtered. So there's an extra up to over a year where they're extracting nutrients from their environment. And so the nutrient levels in that type of food that is not killed at 14 to 16 months, but is killed at 18 to up to 40 months, that type of meat is going to be much more nutrient dense. And that no one really talks about how long the animal is living before they go to slaughter. And there is a huge difference in the quality of your meat.
And you can really taste that. When I get liver from White Oak or Belcampo, it tastes rich. It's really red. So when I was out at Rome Ranch, I was able to shoot a deer with a gun. I was cheating. I didn't shoot it with a bow. And the liver from this deer is the color of beets. Mm-hmm. It is so red. And I've never seen a liver like that in my life. It was a healthy liver with no scars. And I've eaten some of it raw. It's the most red liver I've ever seen. And this was a doe that I shot. It was probably 3 to 4 years old. So we're talking an animal that's lived on the land and extracted nutrients season after season after season. And that's a wild animal with a really, really red, deeply, darkly bloody liver with tons of nutrients that we're going to talk about today that are crucial for immune health overall. Well, you mentioned a little bit about the Spanish flu. I found that to be an interesting part of the beginning of your book. How was Spanish flu treated effectively? Because this gets back to the sunlight stuff, right?
Yeah.
or at least partially treated effectively.
Yeah. I mean, what they did was, is it was the open air treatment. And essentially they took patients with bird flu, and they didn't realize what it was at the time. I mean, they didn't figure that out actually until a few decades ago. They actually had to dig up a frozen preserved carcass to actually figure out and identify it was bird flu. But how they treated those patients was through sunlight and fresh air. And there's definitely evidence that fresh air has more ozone, has more oxygen, and has antiviral and antibacterial effects because of that. And so if you're breathing, and we know that viruses, including coronavirus, do not live as long if they're exposed to sunlight and fresh air. They live much longer in the darkness with poor ventilation. And so being and breathing fresh air and getting sunlight is absolutely how they primarily treated people back in 1918.
So if we were to have a pandemic of something like coronavirus in 2020, we definitely wouldn't want people to be stuck in their homes, would we? Like, right. The irony here, right? Like no one would say that. That would be a completely bad recommendation to lock down people in their homes, to close parks and public places outdoors, to discourage people from going outside. Like that would be a really bad idea, don't you think?
Well, I mean, it's crazy too. It's so much safer for the healthcare worker too, if they were treating people outside, because think about it. You have really, really sick people with tremendous viral loads. And unless you're wearing and getting fitted with an N95 mask, you're absolutely going to get infected because you are so close to these really sick people. And there's poor ventilation in hospitals. So wouldn't it be cool if you had an outdoor hospital and treating patients like that? It would be probably so much better for the health of the patient as well as the health of the healthcare provider. If it obviously you could do it in an ambient temperature where people could, you know, survive, of course.
Yeah, not in the winter and Minnesota might be a little cold for everybody.
I mean, but you could figure out ways to improve ventilation and get fresh air in and just crank up the heat. And it's not difficult to get fresh air into a hospital. So, I mean, they probably should explore that because, you know, there is data showing that coronavirus travels through vents and in air ducts, and you could potentially be infecting people at other floors if it's being carried through a vent, like a vent or a duct.
I noticed that in all of the rotations I did in my residency, and even at places like MGH in Boston, which would be considered, quote, the house of God, the Harvard Hospital, the ventilation system, it's like a hermetically sealed canister. They're not letting any outside air in. And I'm thinking, why are they doing this? You know, when I was in college, I went to Costa Rica and I worked in a hospital in on the east coast of Costa Rica in Manuel, I forget the name of it. I'll think of it. Anyway, they had open air rooms, and this hospital was literally a couple hundred feet from the ocean. And you could hear the ocean and smell the ocean, and they would open the windows in the hospital rooms. And right. I thought, this is interesting, right? And it was mostly an open air hospital. It was indoors, but they had windows that I can't even tell you the last time I was in a hospital that had a window that opened. Now, there's liability, you know, you don't want somebody jumping out of a hospital window or falling out of a hospital window. But there's no ventilation in hospitals. It's crazy.
That's what's really interesting you just brought up is that's actually probably the best. That's even better than just getting fresh air. Being close to the ocean, the salinity in the air and the salt in the air is actually higher. And we discussed this in the immunity fix. It's called halotherapy, where essentially you're mimicking salt caves, but you're not in a cave, obviously, right? And getting fresh air off the ocean and getting higher concentrations of salt in the air absolutely has direct antiviral, antibacterial effects. Salt in cell cultures can kill encapsulated and non-encapsulated RNA and DNA viruses. It has mucolytic effects, so it breaks up mucus. And there's a ton of studies, and I cover some of them in the immunity fix, where if you breathe in salty air, there's definitely benefits on immune function, immune cell function, breathing, you know, oxygen saturation, lung health. And they've done numerous studies on this. And so gargling salts, doing nasal salt rinses with sterile water, has been shown to cut the duration of upper respiratory tract infections by 2 days, reduce viral spread among household contacts, reduce viral shedding. And so that's just kind of interesting. You brought up this point that like this hospital is close to, you know, the ocean, and that's just an added benefit of getting breathing in salt.
Yeah, I remember the name. It's Hospital Tony Facio Castro. in Limon, Costa Rica. So people can look that up. It's nothing impressive, but it was pretty cool. That was these open wards. So if people are thinking about this, a lot of people won't live near the ocean. Would you recommend like a neti pot with sterile water and salt? I mean, that's actually something that makes a lot of sense to me amidst COVID, but I hadn't thought about it till you just mentioned it. If people are worried about exposure to coronavirus, for instance, what if you travel on a plane, right? What if you have to travel right now? And I know a lot of people are not traveling on planes or choosing to use cars, but what if somebody wears a mask, travels on a plane, does everything with hand washing? When you get to your destination, I wonder if it would be another risk reducing thing to do a neti pot, which for people that don't know, it's kind of an irrigation of the nasal passages and the posterior pharynx with sterile water with salt in it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because, well, first of all, right, you're shedding virus from the mouth and the nasal passages. So what's great about salt is you can actually rinse out both of those orifices, right? You can do sterile water, salt, nasal irrigations, and you can also gargle in your throat with saline solution. The higher the salt concentration, the greater antiviral effects it'll have. So essentially, you can do an isotonic 0.9%, but you're going to have a much greater killing at 3%, a hypertonic type of solution. And neti pots, if you dump one packet in, that just gives you isotonic. So when I do it, I actually dump in about 3 packets and use sterile water. And if I feel like I'm getting sick, I will do hypertonic salt gargles, and I'll also do that type of rinse. And it's interesting too, what about the mouthwashes, right? Like with Listerine mouthwashes have been shown to potentially kill, you know, the shedding of virus in the mouth. So, you know, what if we just did a Listerine wash before we see loved ones too? Could that reduce viral shedding? That's just interesting things that could potentially have some utility.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is when I was talking to a periodontist on the podcast previously, he recommended against Listerine mouthwash because if you kill all the oral flora, it'll change blood pressure stuff because there's a lot of oral flora that make nitric oxide derivatives. So I don't think we want to completely destroy the oral flora, but if you're really worried about shedding virus to somebody, you could see a risk benefit there. But I love the idea of isotonic or hypertonic salt solutions. And just so people know what we're talking about, you could even take filtered water and boil it, right? And then cool it to make your own sterile water. And then if you were, I guess maybe in the show notes, I'll try and put some resource for people so that they know how much salt to add as an isotonic or a hypertonic, a 0.9 or a 3% salt solution per liter of water. So you could do that. And then usually people put a little bit of baking soda in, I think, to make it buffered at least a little bit. And then you can just pour it through your nasal passages. I think it's a great idea for people that don't live near the ocean anymore. I don't live near San Diego anymore, but we should probably all be doing that, especially now. And if you travel, I mean, I just had a friend that traveled home to see her family and she was so worried. Take a neti pot, you know, do a saltwater gargle when you get off the plane. It probably will reduce things at least a little bit. And then when people start, if you start to feel funky, why not do it? Like you said, it's easy. It's totally safe.
Right. Yeah. What I typically do is I'll make sure the water is boiling for about 5 minutes. That way, you know, there's essentially no risk. Or you could just literally get you can buy sterile water or you can buy distilled water, you know, to make it, you know, so it's make sure it's sterile if you're putting anything through your nasal passage, obviously.
Yeah. You don't want that Naegleria. None of the brain eating amoebas. Right. We'll skip those.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So let's think about this for people. So basically let's set the stage for COVID and immunity. And I've talked about this a lot on the podcast, but why don't you reiterate for us who is at most risk for COVID? What are the biggest risk factors for worse COVID-19 outcomes? Every time I talk about this on social media, people always want to roast me and say, your carnivore diet or your animal-based diet can't prevent COVID. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that a nutrient-rich animal-based diet could probably improve your outcome. We're not going to change whether somebody actually gets exposed to COVID-2. But what are the risk factors for worse COVID outcomes from your perspective?
Well, how I would respond to them is I would say, yeah, it's true that if you're over the age of 60, you're at about a 9-fold higher risk of dying from COVID. But if you're vitamin D deficient, you're up to a 15-fold higher risk of dying from COVID. And you can't change your age, but you can absolutely make sure you have sufficient vitamin D levels. And one of the best ways to get vitamin D is through animal foods, not plant foods. So in that aspect, carnivore or animal-based diets win in that aspect because you're getting the active, more active form, right? D3 versus, yes, you can get some D2 in mushrooms. But you know, vitamin, the reason why 1 billion people globally are D deficient is because they're not consuming things like fish or pastured eggs.
Or going in the sun.
Or going in the sun. Yep. You can't do much in the winter when, you know, these pandemics and a lot of these things are rising, and because we're indoors and we're spreading it more too. But there's the key again, that animal foods comes back to the forefront again. In the highest, and I've never seen anything that increases the risk of dying from COVID more than D deficiency, especially severe D deficiency.
Yeah, I've spoken about a lot of that data recently on my podcast and on Controversial Thoughts. There was recently a headline in some journal saying that 9 out of 10 COVID deaths could possibly be attributed to vitamin D deficiency. And then Ivor did some great work looking at the average levels of 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which is one of the forms of vitamin D in the body, and comparing it with Italian women to Japanese individuals. And the rates were just off the charts. So like there was a large amount of the population in Japan that had over 30 nanograms per ml, and a very like 12% in Italy had that level of vitamin D. And so, yeah, I think that vitamin D from food is a great start, but I'm so also intrigued, and we won't go down this rabbit hole now, by the other things that are made in our skin with sunlight and ultraviolet exposure, which again, kind of brings us back to this, let's just say, you know, a little bit absurd notion that over the past summer, we're in the winter now, and we have this endemic virus, which clearly is seasonal. We know that deaths across all countries and mortality increases in the winter for a variety of reasons, one of them being probably this cloistering of humans and less vitamin D and less activity. But in the summer, when there was sunlight for everybody to harvest, we certainly wouldn't want people to be locked indoors. We wouldn't want to discourage people from going outside, would we? And anyway, the way the whole thing's been handled is just absurd to me. So yeah, I think I've talked about vitamin D a lot. I don't think we need to go a whole lot into that one, other than to say that even here in Texas, I got a portable vitamin D box for myself. I got a portable light box, and we get a lot of sun in the winter, but there's a lot of days like today that are kind of gloomy. So I've got a portable, you know, kind of vitamin D lamp, and this company won't sponsor the podcast anymore. They never would sponsor the podcast in the first place. So I keep talking about them because I think this is such a great idea, but they won't sponsor the podcast. So I probably will not mention their name, no affiliation.
Well, the thing that's interesting, I was thinking about getting a vitamin D box too. And there's something inherently inside of me that is thinking, I don't know if we can directly replicate the sun. So, and I get that you can probably, if you only do it for a few minutes, they're more concentrated. I don't know. I think I would love to see more data on the safety of those type of things. But I think those vitamin D boxes are much better than tanning beds, because I think tanning beds are like 90% UVA, I want to say, and the D boxes are only like 75%. So like there's less risk.
It depends on the lamp and the tanning bed and all this stuff. I did some research about it when I lived in Seattle for residency and looked at how much UVA versus UVB was in the sun versus in these. But yeah, it's interesting. And I think that there's probably something to it. And I think they can be beneficial. So what are the other things you see as risk factors? So we got vitamin D deficiency. People should know how to fix that. Like that's, we got that one covered. What else is there?
There's a secondary fix to vitamin D deficiency, and that is magnesium deficiency, which about probably 50% of the general population is deficient in for numerous reasons, mostly being hyperinsulinemia, which causes you to spill magnesium in the urine, as well as insulin resistance, where you can't even get magnesium into the cell. And that's probably 75% of the deficiency in magnesium is probably being driven by those factors. And of course, obviously poor intake as well. But you do need magnesium in order to activate vitamin D. So that would be number 2 nutrient. If you want to get the most benefits of your vitamin D, make sure you have good magnesium status.
And I love that you highlighted that. That came up when I was talking to Tro a couple of months ago, this notion that magnesium deficiency is rampant, but I've never heard many people besides you and maybe him and some others talk about the fact that the majority of that magnesium deficiency is related to metabolic dysfunction.
Yeah.
And certainly there are a lot of people out there who are not consuming enough magnesium because they're not eating animal foods and whole non-processed, less toxic plant foods, but, or maybe spring water or other sources of magnesium. If you could get a magnesium deficiency if you were eating junk food, because there's no magnesium in processed food, but you would also probably get metabolic dysfunction as you were doing all that stuff right along with it. So, but the idea is that we are wasting magnesium when we are, quote, insulin resistant. So I think the majority of the ultimate root cause fix for magnesium deficiency is probably going to be, again, helping people understand metabolic health, how to correct insulin resistance. And it's like a double, it's like a two birds with one stone. You change the diet in a way that makes it more magnesium rich. You're probably going to fix metabolic health or at least improve it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people miss that. They want to just like keep eating a poor diet and you know, supplement. But yeah, if you are eating these inflammatory diets and you're damaging your intestine, you can't even absorb these vitamins and minerals well. And so, and the other aspect is the dramatic oxidative stress that is taxing your vitamins and minerals, because our antioxidant enzymes are literally built off of cofactors like minerals, right? Superoxide dismutase needs copper, zinc, manganese. And almost every single antioxidant enzyme in some way is going to depend on minerals and vitamins from that aspect. So if you're eating a crappy diet, you are literally depleting yourself of nutrients, and you are dramatically reducing any type of benefit you would even get from a supplement.
You're not going to absorb it. And that's one of the, yeah, that's why we both favor real food above anything, but you have to fix the gut first. And that's connected with everything else we're going to talk about.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, some people too, they're eating mostly well, but then they're also, you know, ingesting seed oils and they're eating ice cream. And, you know, you got to remove the bad too. You can't just eat, you know, an animal-based diet and then also eat bad stuff and think you're going to fix yourself.
Yeah. You know, every once in a while, people will say that to me, and I'm just a heartbreaker on all these podcasts these days. They'll say, I love my meat, but I love my hot sauce. And I'm thinking, I don't know. I mean, there's definitely some studies out there that would suggest that the capsaicin, and though there's some studies that show benefit to that, these nightshade plants, whether it's the chilies or the tomatoes, or that those can be really disruptive via certain lectins to the gut lining. And I'm thinking that's probably not good for, you know, you can eat liver all you want, but if you're eating liver plus steak and you're putting hot sauce on your steak, it could be, you know, you could be harming the gut. And so thinking about that, I'll do future episodes that are more about the gut and the gut lining. But we do have to think like, yeah, I mean, you can eat the good stuff, which is a step in the right direction. But if you don't take out the bad stuff, it may not be as effective for a variety of reasons.
Right.
So yeah. Now, so I think from my perspective, those are the biggest things. And a lot of it is lifestyle. It's metabolic health, insulin resistance, things I've talked about frequently in the past. Yeah. And obviously it's connected with obesity, nutrient poor diets, vitamin D. And so, you know, it's funny. I got an email from a good friend the other day, and he's nearly 70 years old. And this is a pretty fit guy. And he goes, I spent 40 minutes in the car in a closed cab of a truck with a guy who had COVID. And I got what I thought was like 2/3 of a mild cold for 3 days. This is a guy who's 67 years old. Now, granted, this guy's a rock star. He exercises. He thinks about his diet, and he's certainly in the sun. He's very tan. He's very metabolically healthy. But that's the continuum. You know, you can be a 67-year-old that probably will crush this, or you can be a 40-year-old who ends up in the ICU if you have low vitamin D status, poor metabolic health, and a lot of the other stuff we'll talk about at the end. You know, maybe poor sleep, increased stress, and no circadian rhythm in general, and no attention to when you're eating. So that's the way I draw it for people. And even though this is, you know, a virus that is serious and is killing people, and obviously both James and I are empathetic to anyone that's been negatively affected by it, yeah, the message that we're trying to shout from the rooftops is there's more ability to address this than we're being told.
Right.
Maybe right now I'll just ask you a couple of controversial questions. Number one, what do you think of the vaccine? And then I'll ask the second one.
Okay. Yeah. So, okay. Well, number one, you always have to be a little more skeptical for any type of intervention, like a vaccine, where the drug company is essentially not liable if they hurt you, right? Number one. Number two, they have a lot to profit from it. So you have to look at it with a very skeptical eye, not saying that instantly makes these vaccines not effective, not saying that at all. You have to look at this stuff much more with a much more skeptical eye, though. And who is monitoring this study? If it's being monitored by the study sponsor, I can tell you right now, when I've looked at many medical studies, and if they're being monitored not by a contract research organization, which is an independent organization, if they are being monitored by the study sponsor, the probability that the results will be positive are much greater, and the probability that there'll be any side effects are much less. So that tells you something. So that's one. And, you know, if you look at the FDA briefing documents for some of these vaccine studies, yes, the side effects don't look too bad. There definitely is a lot of injection site reactions, don't get me wrong, but serious side effects, there might be a small increased risk of appendicitis, maybe a very tiny increased risk of ventricular arrhythmias, but who's reporting these and who's monitoring these? And I can tell you right now, I have not seen a very clear, transparent document that says this is independently monitored by a contract research organization. The study sponsor has no involvement and the researchers have no ties to the industry. And until I see something like that, I'm highly skeptical of the quote unquote efficacy and safety. So that's one. Number two, and if you talk to numerous scientists, they have said that they have skipped over the animal studies that you would actually need to definitively prove that a vaccine prevents a disease. And what you have to do is you have to vaccinate an animal and you actually have to give them that virus to confirm that the vaccine reduces either the risk of the disease or whatnot and doesn't make it worse. Well, I'm pretty sure I've never seen any animal studies on these types of new viruses that have confirmed that it does work in animals. I'm pretty sure they skipped those studies and they simply went to looking at PCR positivity rates. Now, to me, that is a very controversial endpoint. And so even the efficacy, in my opinion, is not based on very, very sound scientific evidence, so to speak.
They really have rushed it. And there's a pretty chilling video of good old Bill Gates saying, you know, we're just going to have to accept the risk if we want this vaccine in a more accelerated time frame. And I do think I hope the vaccine is effective. And I agree with you on all of those counts. And I just want everyone listening to know that my parents will probably take the vaccine. That's their choice. I haven't given them any advice, yay or nay. And because of that, I very much hope that there are low side effects and that it is safe for them. My parents are both 70 years old. But I also want people to know that there is no recourse if this vaccine harms people to sue the manufacturers. That has been completely indemnified. That people should be very aware of that there is actually there's no recourse for that. And I believe that may have even started with Ronald Reagan and beyond that like it's very hard to seek damages from vaccine manufacturers. By taking a vaccine, you are essentially accepting the risk with that vaccine. You have no legal recourse if you are harmed by that vaccine. Now, you may also have your life saved by that vaccine if you are someone that is metabolically unhealthy and you would have had a very poor COVID outcome. But I do want people to understand that there's no recourse here, and this vaccine has been rushed. So
And one thing too is like, if most of us have already been exposed to COVID, do we need the vaccine too?
Right.
That's just another controversial thought to consider. And I'm not saying that the vaccine may not be effective. I'm just saying that I am highly skeptical from the years of looking at FDA reviewers' reviews of clinical studies by pharma and then comparing that to publications in the New England Journal of Medicine saying these things work well and don't have side effects. And I'll tell you, there is a huge discrepancy between there have been medications approved where the main FDA safety and efficacy reviewer have voted non-approval and it still gets approved. And so it just blows my mind that anyone can just read a study from New England Journal of Medicine and say, oh my gosh, this vaccine, its efficacy is great and it has low side effects. If you weren't an actual FDA reviewer, you have no idea how sound that actual data is.
Yeah.
I just want people to really understand that.
Yeah. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. All right. Second question that I should have asked earlier. Do you think this one jumped to humans from animals, or is it a lab creation? Because this is a tough one. Like, I don't know. I see things on both sides that make me think scary shit.
I don't even want, I don't want to even try to guess, because data saying that it didn't even come from Wuhan and that there were other strains potentially available. And I think it's going to be a very, very controversial topic. I think most of the evidence does suggest that it came from an animal and it's not lab created, but I think there's is there the possibility of that? I guess. Yeah.
I just hope it wasn't. I hope this isn't a biological one. It brings us down all sorts of conspiracy theories. All right, let's veer back to the realm of science a little bit. So I talked about this on a previous podcast with Tommy Wood, but talk to me a little bit about what goes wrong with the immune system. People with metabolic dysfunction, and what's going on with the immune system that's predisposing people to these really bad COVID outcomes. So talk, like, how's the immune system getting disordered?
So that was one of the reasons why I decided to publish the book, is because we came out with several publications on what we think is actually going on. And the two primary things that are definitely driving a lot of these poor COVID outcomes is number one, a reduction in the production of type 1 interferons. And so we produce these interferons to interfere with the virus and help us produce antiviral antibodies. And so as we have this immunosenescence through eating a poor diet primarily, right, not getting sun and not eating an animal-based diet, so to speak, you end up having a reduction in the production of type 1 interferons. And so what that means is you don't clear the virus more, and you get much more healthy cells infected with the virus. And that means you have to kill those healthy cells that are now infected with the virus. It's going to increase your risk of a cytokine storm. The other factor driving this is a reduction in the adaptive immune system. Your B cells and your T cells, they go down. It's called lymphopenia, and they don't work as well either, primarily the CD8 T killer cells. And so those CD8 T killer cells can actually kill in a silent apoptotic way. And when you get a reduction in those cells, now you have to rely on the more inflammatory killing of the innate immune system, like the white blood cells, right, which are much more inflammatory killing, macrophages. So when you have a drop in your adaptive immune system, that is another huge driver. And that's, of course, simply driven through poor diet and poor lifestyle.
Yeah. So this, you talk about this in the book, and it was something that I had found fascinating before, this neutrophil lymphocyte ratio. Yeah. And I'll just show a paper here for people. And this is a paper I've probably shown 6 times in the last 6 months. The title is "The Relationship Between the Neutrophil Lymphocyte Ratio and Insulin Resistance in Newly Diagnosed Type 2 Diabetes Mellitus Patients." And, you know, you can imagine the conclusion is increased neutrophil lymphocyte ratio was significantly associated with IR, that's insulin resistance. High NLR values may be a reliable predictor of IR. And so, yeah, it's exactly like you're talking about, this idea that when we get insulin resistant, that the interferons are probably not produced, which is a separate arm, but also there's an imbalance between these innate and adaptive immune arms. And this adaptive arm goes down, and the innate arm with neutrophils, macrophages, dendritic cells goes up. And what do we see with COVID? We see these outcomes, and we can talk a little bit about long COVID. People have asked me about that. But we see these outcomes where people really, you know, they get this original infection. You said people die with COVID over 2 to 3 weeks. Well, for some of these people, the clinical course is a little bit of some convalescence, a little bit of sickness. They get a little better, and then they get really worse suddenly as the immune system can't resolve the inflammation that has started. Because inflammation is a term that gets used and bandied about all over the place, and very few people really understand it, but it's this crosstalk, this cytokine milieu, this cytokine text or tweet storm between the immune system cells saying, hey, there's, you know, cleanup on aisle 5, we've got a pathogen. And if, imagine that you're in a store, I was going to say Walmart, but then I hope none of you are in Walmart, because that place gives me nightmares, you know, and they're saying cleanup on aisle 5. And then they go over there, and when they start cleaning up aisle 5, they start a fire on aisle 5. And then there's a freaking like blaze in aisle 5 of the grocery store. And as they're trying to resolve it, they start a fire, you know, and then things get way worse. And you know, in the worst case scenario, the whole grocery store burns down, the patient dies, and you have a horrible COVID outcome, and it's tragic. And so this, we've known this forever, and we've seen these outcomes in people with obesity as well, that the immune system is just clearly disordered when we have this underlying issue happening. And so this is another paper I've talked about, impact of obesity and metabolic syndrome on immunity. This nexus of these two is such an interesting thing. And I love that, you know, you wrote this book to really highlight this as well, because your immune system is not your immune system, right? Your immune right. system is an endocrine system, and we need to stop siloing things in medicine and saying, oh, you're an immunologist, therefore you can talk about COVID. Well, really, if we're thinking about it that way, the endocrinologist should be the one talking about COVID, right? Yeah. And right. so that to me is really striking. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, you know, what was sort of interesting, because I was kind of confused, right? Because we're taught that adaptive immunity, you have to be exposed to that exact pathogen. And then if you get through it, then the adaptive immune system is beneficial, right? That's what we've been taught. But there is cross sensitivity, and we need to understand that we get our long-term immunity through our adaptive immune system. So B cells producing antibodies gives us several months of immunity. T cells can have memory lasting decades. So if you have a reduction in T and B cell function, your long-term adaptive memory of a coronavirus, let's say a common cold that you got 10 years ago, which may have now looked at the structure of this new coronavirus, and you may have had some cross sensitivity and remembrance. But if you have a reduction in that memory, now your previous adaptive immunity isn't helping you with SARS-CoV-2. So we need to understand adaptive immunity isn't something that you have to get that exact virus and then it's beneficial. It's already beneficial from previous coronavirus exposures. It's just not, let's say you're not 100% immune, but the structure of SARS-CoV-2 is very similar to other coronaviruses, and there is certainly cross sensitivity.
And on some of the previous controversial thoughts videos I'd done, I'd shown some papers in flu vaccinations suggesting that those with metabolic dysfunction were less likely to form a long-term memory response sure. with the crosstalk between the CD8 T cells and the rest of the immune system. And so we know that the vaccine is less effective when the immune system doesn't work well. And we know the immune system doesn't work well when we have metabolic dysfunction. So I love right. it. All right. Stealing that from Matthew McConaughey. That was the first 45 minutes of the podcast with James and Nicola Antonio. We talked about all kinds of cool stuff. The role of animals in pandemics, that kind of harkens back to what I talked about with Frank von Hippel. Just the fact that we're so clustered. Farming is crazy. We talked about sunlight and fresh air, salty water. When I travel to Puerto Rico, I am going to be using a neti pot to clean my nasal passages out. And we talked about COVID outcomes. Should we trust the COVID-19 vaccine? There are already reports of side effects. Who knows? How the immune system gets disordered and the impact of metabolic syndrome and obesity on immunity. So much good stuff in that one. Next week, we have part two, which is how to create metabolic health. We're going to talk about a high linoleic acid diet and increasing oxidative stress in humans. We're going to talk about premature atherosclerosis and a monogenic cause of insulin resistance called Dunnigan familial lipodystrophy. We're going to talk about fructose questions and why ketogenic diets are amazing, but also filled with dogma, why they can be harmful. Nutrients required for immunity. We're going to talk about colostrum and vaccines. And we're going to talk about environmental hormesis and hot and cold. So tune in next week for part two with James DiNicolantonio, my buddy. Check his book out, The Immunity Fix. And I hope you guys are all having an amazing holiday season. I'm going to Puerto Rico with a team from Heart and Soil. Of course, while I'll be working from there, I'll be answering emails from there. If you have questions, you can always email me, drpaul@heartandsoil.co. Questions about our products, questions about how to construct a nose-to-tail animal-based diet. That's the big thing happening with me, you guys. I'm super excited about all kinds of adventures I have coming up in January. I'm going to Montana. I'm going to Utah to go skiing. I'm going to Africa in February. Love you all. Stay rad.